Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, the assistant editor of the New Books Network. And you're listening to New Books in Political Science. Today I'm speaking with Zeynep Pamuk about her new book, Politics and Expertise, How to Use Science in a Democratic Society, from Princeton University Press. Zeynep is an assistant professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. Her work exists at the intersection between political theory and the philosophy of science. There are few thinkers today thinking about the relationship between science and democracy in a manner as nuanced and thorough as Zeynep. Her new book is a much-needed intervention in the fiery ongoing debates surrounding the politics of both COVID-19 and climate change. Zeynep, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
So first question I'd like to ask is, what is your background and what inspired you to write this book?
I'm originally from Istanbul, Turkey. I did my undergrad at Yale. So I came to the U.S. at the age of 18. I did my undergrad. And then I went to Harvard for graduate school and did my PhD in government. And then I went to Oxford for a postdoctoral fellowship at St. John's College. And then I started my current job at the University of California, San Diego, in the political science department. So my interest in these issues started as an undergrad. I was interested or concerned in climate change and environmental problems more broadly. So I designed a concentration for myself on environmental politics. I was interested in conflicts over rivers, on climate change mitigation measures. I was interested in environmental architecture, on green economics. So these kinds of issues I wanted to explore more, and these motivated me to apply for a PhD in political science. But when I got to grad school, as I was looking more into the literature on climate change, I realized that there was a lot of work, especially in moral and political philosophy, on different ways to deal with climate change, whose responsibility it was to take on mitigation burdens, who owed what to future generations. I thought there was incredibly important and valuable work on these topics, but there was so little political uptake. At that point, we were reaching, we had already reached a stalemate. The issue didn't seem to be going anywhere, even as we were seeing the scientific predictions come true. We were watching them being realized, and there was no political action. So I started thinking that that we needed more academic study of the reasons why science became so so contested in the political sphere, why issues on which it looked like there were accurate scientific predictions, good studies, didn't get the uptake in the political sphere that seemed to be needed. So I became more interested in this as a political issue. And I thought, at least in political science, there wasn't that much study of the intersection of science and politics. So I thought, this is how I will study these issues.
You discuss a lot of the history of this kind of thinking of the relationship between science and politics. Broadly speaking, what are the common or typical frameworks that we have for understanding the relationships between politics and science?
So the question of expertise and its relationship to politics goes back to the ancient Greeks. Plato problematized this issue. He argued that democracies would not recognize expertise, and he himself developed an argument for philosopher kings. So it was a form of expert rule. The expertise in question there, though, was not the kind of technical expertise that we associate with scientists today. So that's more of a kind of means to an end, kind of instrumental expertise, whereas in Plato's case, the expertise in question was about the good life, how best we should live. And he argued that philosophers possess this expertise, and that's why they should be given the authority to rule. So this approach to expertise, I think, is has been the more common one, the thinking, asking the question of whether democracies will possess this kind of knowledge about the good, and whether those who possess this knowledge should rule. So we can think of the question as having these two different components. But I think in questions around scientific expertise and the kind of expertise that became more prominent with the rise of modern science, the claim that this will also give us answers to questions about how to live has receded. So scientists do not make this claim. In fact, they make the opposite claim. And it's interesting to think about the historical reasons why this came to be, that scientists started making a claim to neutrality, to not making any judgments about how we should live, just pointing out answers to the question of how things are. There's interesting work, more historical work on this question. And some answers are more about the pressures that scientists faced in trying to defend what they were doing from political pressures, in trying to respond to claims that they were posing a threat to religion, for example. This has always been a tension between science and religion, just as much as science and politics. And I think the neutrality claim was a form of defense for science. It allowed scientists to get on with what they were doing without necessarily threatening these other spheres. Of course, it's inevitable that these spheres come into conflict. And neutrality is not only strictly speaking, impossible and false, and we know that science isn't purely neutral, but also it didn't really persuade either. So scientists have always been accused of having designs about what we ought to do, and that their claims always come with a political agenda. So this has been the tension historically. And we see this at various episodes, whether it's about the teaching of evolution, whether it's about the atomic bomb, and then there's climate change, vaccines, you name it. So again and again, these kinds of tensions crop up. And it's always about the relationship between the ends that scientists may presuppose or scientific knowledge may seem to push towards, and then the more political, in our case, more democratic ends that others might have.
A scholar that you repeatedly bring up, mostly in the context of criticism, is Max Weber. And you talk about how Max Weber's notion of science and the scientist's role in politics has very much defined our understanding. What was Weber's conception, and what is your issue with this framework?
So Weber argued for a strict separation between facts and values. He thought, so he was writing about this in the context of bureaucrats, so not strictly natural scientists, but more in the context of bureaucracy. And he argued that bureaucrats should aim to be objective, do neutral assessments, and stay out of the value business. So I'm not suggesting that Weber didn't realize how difficult this would be. In fact, he was motivated by the observation that bureaucrats would always bring in their own personal commitments, their attachments into the business of doing objective calculations that would facilitate a kind of more technical, rational form of government or management. The problem is that this kind of objective calculation he assumed would be possible. He focused on a more certain kind of knowledge. So the iron cage that he wrote about presupposes the idea that the bureaucrats who make this kind of calculation that depoliticize the world, that objectify social and political affairs or calculate human actions would be possible, and that this would squeeze out the room for agency, for human judgment, for politics, for leadership, and so on. But in reality, when we look at the calculations themselves, the kind of actual work required in managing the world and predicting human affairs, we see that actually it's extremely difficult. It's impossibly complicated, and it's governed by uncertainty through and through. So when we look at the practice of science, of technical calculation related to human affairs, the kind of objective calculation, the strict separation of facts and values looks impossible. So you could say that Weber argued for approaching an ideal that was maybe impossible, but that we could approximate fairly well, or that we should aim to approximate. And I think that's a good reading of what he was doing, that he set this out as guidance for bureaucrats. This is what you should aim to do. Keep out your values. Just seek objective knowledge. But if you can't attain the ideal in its best form, sometimes trying to approximate it is not the best way to go about trying to achieve it. Because if we know that the technical experts who are doing these calculations will bring their own values, will bring their own worldviews, under uncertainty, they will make certain trade-offs, they will make value-laden assessments of risk. If we know that they're going to do this, saying, oh, you should try not to do it may not be adequate. We might need a different approach altogether. And that's what I try to do in my book. So I kind of set my approach in contrast to a view that says, oh, just try as much as possible to separate the facts and values. Even if it's impossible, this is what experts should always aim to do. And I say, because we know that's not possible, we should have a different approach altogether. And that's how I frame the argument.
This lack of separation between, you know, fact-finding and values obviously has political implications. What are some of the immediate political implications that we see, especially when it comes to scientists acting in a political advisory role, and the challenges with being honest about the uncertainty or the value-laden aspects of science?
So one neat thing about the fact-value distinction and any division of labor between experts and non-experts that is rooted in it is that it makes very clear what the role of the experts is, and it essentially puts clear boundaries around it. So if experts are just telling us how things are, and if that's the way things are, then we don't have to worry about their influence in the political sphere. They don't have additional input in the democratic process. They are not taking on the judgment or usurping any kind of political authority or role. But once we discard this as unrealistic, as unattainable, perhaps even undesirable, then the problem is that any judgment, any advice, any scientific recommendation that comes from an expert is also going to have embedded within it judgments about what to do, what's the best political response. And this will be within the part that appears to be technical. So this is the concern. It would be one thing if scientists said, if it were possible for scientists to say, this is our scientific observation or finding, and then based on this, we think we ought to do this. So this model, which people still, again and again, like during the COVID crisis, people think this is what scientists should do and they shouldn't make recommendations about what we ought to do. Well, that's all very well, but actually in the way the science has been conducted, there already are these kinds of judgments there. They've made judgments about what part of the problem to study, which kinds of variables they can accept as more uncertain or more approximate, and which ones they want to get fully right, which variables to include in the first place, how to define their concepts, where to set thresholds of certainty, how much evidence they accept as sufficient to reach a certain conclusion. All of these are within the scientific process, and they involve judgments about what's important, what's significant, what's relevant, what's politically useful. And this kind of knowledge then incorporates judgments about political affairs, but it arrives in the guise of the way things are, of scientific knowledge. And this is the problem that expertise poses in a democracy, that the expertise we get already incorporates judgments about its own significance and the purposes that can be pursued with it. And that limits what we can do. And it also gives experts more say, more of a right to shape what we should do than other citizens or representatives, policymakers, and so on.
In the book, you discuss what you refer to as the paradox of scientific advice. What is the paradox of scientific advice?
So scientific advisors, when they come to the policy sphere, they're expected to give advice that is neutral. So do not take political sides and do not make recommendations about what we ought to do, which policy we ought to adopt based on the science. But at the same time, their main task is to give advice that's useful for policy purposes. And usefulness already incorporates conceptions of what interests we should take into account, what we might want to do. The paradox is that the more you or scientific advisors try to give useful advice that anticipates whose interests we might be speaking to or what kinds of policies we may pursue, the more they move away from neutrality. But if they really stick to the task of staying neutral, then they resort to technicalities that are really irrelevant. They refrain from thinking about what others may want to do with the knowledge that they're presenting. And that creates a gap between the knowledge and the context in which it's going to be used. So to give useful advice, you have to be less neutral. You have to think of who's receiving your advice. If you think of a one-on-one relationship, say with a financial advisor, a good financial advisor will take into account their client's preferences, needs, risk aversion, life plans, all of these things. But scientists are told not to take into account any of this. So they're pushed towards giving purely technical advice, and then they become less useful. If they become useful or try to be useful, then they're no longer neutral, and then they're accused of being partisan, of having their own agenda. So it's an impossible task that's presented to them. And this is what I call the paradox of scientific advice.
If we want to put your ideas into practice, it would be best off if we start to accept the fact that scientists aren't necessarily engaged in pointing to what truth is, and at the same time that scientists are informed by pressure to try and be apolitical or non-political. So something that you make a proposal for is you say that we need a science court. And this isn't your idea. You didn't invent this idea. This is actually has political origins. So what is the history of this idea of a science court? And what would a science court look like that would help to mediate this problem of the paradox of scientific advice?
So I stumbled upon this idea as I was reading on some science policy debates from the 60s and 70s. For obvious reasons, that was a period when science policy was really more in the forefront of political debates. There was a closer relationship between presidents and scientific advisors. Scientists were sometimes called the fifth estate, so they had much more direct political power. But the same sorts of issues that we see in the use of science in politics today, problems with scientific disagreement, uncertainty, scientists being accused of not being neutral, of some scientists confusing the public or trying to get their own agenda through. These issues happen regularly, and they happened at like a perhaps in a more serious scale and a more well, now with the pandemic, these things have again become very very critical, very public, and back then it was about the atomic bomb, but there were various issues, and scientists were accused of being political, of distorting the truth. So an engineer and policymaker called Arthur Kantrowitz decided or suggested, based on exactly these complaints about the handling of science in the public sphere, that we should institute a science court in which scientists with different views would make their case, and there'd be a panel of scientist judges, and they would settle the disagreement. So they would rule in favor of one or the other, or maybe they would say, they'd pick some in-between position, and they would settle the debate for policy purposes. So it wasn't meant to end scientific controversy. So it wasn't a court that ended, that could be used for peer review purposes, but it was designed to settle scientific issues for public affairs. So I thought this was a very interesting idea, and it was also wildly popular. 28 different scientific organizations endorsed it. President Ford and Jimmy Carter was running against, and they both endorsed it. And this was, they set out to have a trial of the court. So it was, there was big uptake, and it was very much in the news, and it seemed to be a popular idea. The problem that I saw with the court was that it had a clear technocratic bent. So it was designed to give a scientific answer, and these experts were called in to resolve a dispute between experts. So there was not much role for ordinary citizens. There was not much role for political judgments or considering the political implications. So to be clear, it was based on a fact-value separation. The scientist would settle the science, and then that science would be fed into the policymaking process. And I thought this just built on an epistemology that I had criticized. But I thought the idea itself, if sufficiently reworked, could be very valuable. So I set out to do that. So I reimagined the court. I said, first of all, let's not have a separation of facts and values. Let's have an issue with the scientific component, whether it's about which climate change mitigation policy to adopt, or whether it's a choice between adaptation or mitigation, whether it's a decision about lockdowns or vaccine mandates, mask mandates, something with a policy component and a scientific component. And I also suggested replacing the expert judges with citizen jurors. So I was drawing on a literature in democratic theory that argued for these small-scale institutions, but they had very different features. They were mostly deliberative, and experts were brought into informed discussion, but they were, again, essentially providing information that citizens could then use to deliberate, whereas I wanted the action to be about the dispute between the scientists. So disagreeing scientists would make their case, and the citizen jurors would listen to them, ask questions, scientists would cross-examine one another, like in a jury trial, and then the citizens would deliberate about the policy and come up with a recommendation.
What would you say this, that your notion of a science court basically flips the original notion on its head, where yours is about underlining the fact that there is dissent and there is dispute in the scientific community and creating more transparency around this, as opposed to trying to establish truth or fact, which is what this original court would have done. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes, I really like how you put it. That is entirely accurate. And in a way that changes both the purpose of the court and also how we think about the way scientific issues are politicized generally. So I think there has always been this desire for or push toward arriving at a consensus. And that's I think, I mean, now I'm maybe speculating a bit, but that's probably motivated by the idea that there is one truth, that if there are many different views, someone must be wrong, misguided, or, you know, pushing a political agenda or something. And there's always been this pressure for scientists themselves to reach an agreement among themselves, to have one consensus view, even if they can't say this is the truth, that at least they should make their best effort to come up with one scientific position that can then be presented as, you know, our best science now. And of course, the original science court was designed to get experts to reach that kind of settlement, to rule on what we could take as true for now. I thought that was just based on a bad view of science. I think in the vast majority of cases where science become politicized, there actually are a range of scientific views which enjoy some degree of support. There's usually quite a bit of uncertainty. Or you could just say that the science court or this kind of approach works best for science on which there is disagreement. So if an issue has been settled, if there's a vast consensus around it, for example, as there is around the fact that climate change is happening, then maybe that's not the kind of issue you take up in a court. But on the majority of issues that surround this kind of claim that's settled, there isn't a similar consensus, and scientists are trying to figure out, and there are lots of different views floating around. So my idea was to examine their assumptions, to see what implications they had, and then to allow citizens to weigh the risks, the trade-offs, after understanding how uncertain the science was. And as you said, to be transparent about it, to be clear about the limits of science. And I thought the reaching such clarity would also allow citizens to see the points in which there was agreement, what seemed to be settled science. So it would give us a sense of the scope of the disagreement, the bounds of what was scientifically feasible or what appeared to be plausible and what seemed to be completely open, and then make decisions based on acknowledgement of uncertainty and disagreement rather than trying to settle on one truth, which just didn't exist at that time. So that was the aim.
Another aspect of science and politics that you discuss in the book is the whole process of funding for research. And you talk about some of the early history in the U.S. of scientific funding occurring during World War II and really starting up after. And you discuss Vannevar Bush and FDR and their conceptions of scientific research, as well as Michael Polanyi. What were their ideas around scientific research funding, and how have these ideas sort of influenced the present day funding?
So the reason why I wanted to study funding and direct attention towards science funding was the view that the science we have, the kind of questions that are explored, can be traced back to much earlier decisions about which projects should get funding. Science today is a very expensive enterprise. It requires millions, billions of dollars, and it's not possible to have science that doesn't enjoy some kind of funding support. So this means that the way scientific issues shape public debate is usually influenced in a way that perhaps is difficult to trace immediately, but in some way by decisions made much earlier around the distribution of grants. Now, this didn't used to be the case, and I was interested in how and when science became a funding-dependent enterprise, how it expanded, and that brought me to these debates right after World War II. So before that, science was more of an individual enterprise. It was pursued by people who had some means themselves, or maybe they were geniuses, or they had some institutional or university support. Science, of course, there were brilliant scientists then, but we didn't have the kind of big science, the funding-dependent science, until after World War II. So this was due to the success of scientists in winning the war and the public perception that it was scientists who had contributed greatly to the war effort and the success. Science policy, people wanted to capitalize on this and get more funds from the federal government to make science as it was during the war effort, continue. But of course, they had to come up with a rationale, because the in wartime, it's clear what you're paying scientists for. They had to devise a rationale that would suit ordinary affairs. So Vannevar Bush, who was a science policy advisor to FDR, developed this justification of why, of what science could do for Americans. And it was entirely about material progress, about economic growth, about solving various economic and social problems, and putting this vision of a science-dependent, technologically fueled growth for many decades to come. Now, in some ways, I think many people would find that vision appealing, attractive, but it was an entirely top-down vision, and it didn't have any room for political concerns, for issues that different citizens might prioritize. So it was a kind of economically driven worldview, and it was purely elitist. So it didn't have any input whatsoever. It wasn't debated in Congress much, but it was a massive funding effort. And the idea was, so the key point of his argument was that all of these benefits that he listed, benefits that people may well want, would come about if scientists were given complete autonomy over the distribution of funds. And this, it was a wild claim to make because it was an untested one. There was no prior experience with this level of funding given to any community of professionals. So scientists would have this unique position of having full autonomy over the distribution of public funds. And the claim was that this is how the public would most be benefited. He didn't really have any evidence to show for this, but he drew heavily on Michael Polanyi's writing. And Polanyi argued that the way science progressed was that each scientist would build on the work of other scientists, and only the expert in that area would know best what the next step should be. So he basically argued that science could not be guided toward any end. So this was, the opponent here was as a kind of social planning view that, for example, would put forward particular social problems and have scientists design more quote-unquote applied solutions to problems, or respond more directly to issues that citizens would want solved. This view was opposed to that, was suggesting that that's not how science works, that's not how you get scientific progress. Scientists have to be given complete free rein to pursue their curiosity. And Polanyi, in turn, drew on economic metaphors. He was friends with Hayek, and Hayek, I think, was influenced by Polanyi's view about this invisible hand mechanism of free pursuit of curiosity leading to the greatest discovery. But of course, these were unsupported. And the idea that science moves in this way towards some vision of the truth, there was no reason to think that. And actually, someone like Thomas Kuhn was arguing precisely that this is not how science works, that this kind of incremental progress toward the truth painted a false picture of scientific progress. But this was the vision that behind the science funding protocol that the U.S. adopted, and this vision proved surprisingly lasting. So even if today we wouldn't justify the kind of funding distribution systems we have, going back to the same arguments, perhaps the system put in place has had lasting impact, and it hasn't been changed that dramatically.
So you discuss, regarding scientific research, the fact that it shouldn't just be the scientists who are involved in the science itself that should decide where the money comes from, that there other stakeholders should be involved in this. What is your idea about who should get a say and who should be involved in this discussion?
So there are different levels to the question. At the general priority setting level, I think the decision making really should be quite democratic, that this should be determined with congressional input, with perhaps citizen juries having a say over how which issue areas to prioritize, and to some degree shaping the direction of scientific growth, because this has a direct impact on the kinds of social change that we will see over decades, and also on the kinds of policies that become possible to pursue based on scientific knowledge. Now, I don't go so far as to say that the distribution of scientific of funds among scientific projects per se would best be done with direct input from policymakers or citizens, because at that stage, the proposals are very complex and do require, and I don't think that citizens have the kind of expertise to be able to differentiate and distribute funds. But I do, as you were describing, I do argue that giving specialists free rein over distribution of funds is going to create its own pathologies, that it creates people with a stake in certain paradigms, to use Kuhnian language once again, that these people have an interest in seeing their own issue area funded and having a prominent public role. So I think that also creates problems. And there's also some increasing empirical research on how grant distribution is flawed, that it has biases, it's biased against women and minorities, that it doesn't necessarily pick out the most significant discoveries. So the idea that relying on specialists is going to bring about the most significant scientific discoveries, even decades later, we still don't have evidence that this is true. In fact, there's some evidence that it doesn't work that way. So I propose something a bit experimental. I say, why don't we use lotteries or randomization to distribute at least some portion of funds? Because this would allow a truly diverse group of projects to get funding. It would increase the funding and support given to projects that are more idiosyncratic, more different, perhaps those who bring a dissenting perspective. If they go against the mainstream, they're more likely to get funds under a regime that is completely random than one that that is controlled by precisely those people who work under the mainstream view. So I think randomization could have important benefits. So that's the second thing I argue for. A third is about the role of democratic decision making in withdrawing funding from certain areas of science that is highly dangerous and also highly uncertain in its results. And there I look at the kind of scientific research that is likely to lead to high risk technologies. So lethal autonomous weapons, sometimes called killer robots, is one example. Geoengineering, or certain forms of sulfate aerosol injection, that's another example. These are cases where the impacts are going to be severe, they're going to be planetary, and yet scientists still have more or less the same sorts of grant distribution processes with some attention to safety. But this goes way beyond safety. It's about what kind of world we want to live in. And these areas of research have transformative potential. Some might say in some cases good, but in many cases really bad. And this kind of decision, I argue, should not be left to scientists alone.
So for some of these potentially dangerous technologies, where we don't necessarily know what the impacts will be, like with artificial intelligence, for example, one of the arguments that I hear is that even if there is a risk associated with researching artificial intelligence, because China and other potential US competitors are doing this research, it's incumbent on us to do this research. Do you think that, in the ideal system, even you know, there would be some world democratic decision about how scientific research happens, or, you know, in this particular regime that we have ongoing, you know, is there still some necessity for this type of potentially dangerous research?
I see that line of reasoning, definitely. So I don't envision a world government anytime soon, so that's not a possibility that I focus on very much. But I think it's important to think about what other countries are doing, especially since scientific research is now a global enterprise, and there's a lot of both competition and collaboration. And the global aspect is only going to become more important with Chinese scientists really doing a lot of the heavily funded research now. So I think that consideration is important. So I would take it on an issue by issue basis. So what happens if the US stops funding this kind of science? I think in many cases, if US scientists stop funding a certain area, or if they stop pursuing that, it becomes the incentives for other countries to pursue it, or scientists to pursue it, diminish, because science works through collaboration and US labs are the leaders still in many areas. And scientists do not find it advantageous to work in an area where some countries have pulled out completely. That may not be true of also weapons development may not have that structure. And I think that is an area where some kind of international treaty or agreement is probably necessary, because there it would seem that the advantages of developing one when your competitors are not are large. Whereas in other kinds of issues, I think if one group of citizens in a major funder like the US withdraw, then others lose the incentive to pursue it. And in some cases, just one country saying on principle, we're not going to do this, that can give an important message. It carries important weight, perhaps in some kinds of genetic editing, hereditary gene engineering, that might be the crucial move. So there, it seems like that moral message is significant and should be given regardless of whether in that area another country garners some advantage by pursuing research. But in a lot of cases, so if I touch upon this question of gain of function research, which became highly political during the COVID-19 pandemic because of the possibility of a lab leak. And there, the lab that was at the center of the controversy, the Wuhan Virology Institute, was funded by both American and Chinese funders. So actually, NIH funding was going directly to Wuhan, and American scientists were collaborating. So that was clearly a case where if the US funders had said, we are no longer funding this kind of research, which they had actually back in 2014, they'd put a moratorium on this research, perhaps we wouldn't be having the highly charged political debates, controversies around whether the COVID-19 pandemic could have had a lab origin. So while I certainly recognize the international component and that should become part of our assessment, it doesn't fully eliminate the effectiveness or the need for some democratic countries to step up and say they're against certain kinds of science.
Yeah, I find that argument actually really compelling. Another thing I wanted to ask you about in relation to scientific funding is when it comes to private funding. Obviously, private funding has become like a major source of scientific innovation. I think we see this a lot with like in Silicon Valley and with big tech companies. How does your sort of understanding of democracy's role in science apply to private sources?
So the rise of private funding and its increasing importance vis-a-vis public funding gives me great concern, because I argue in the book that funding for science is a huge power, and that power has been wielded by the government, by the public indirectly for many decades, but now it's increasingly in private hands through philanthropy, through privately funded scientific research. So that creates many problems. So at the very basic level, it means that the kinds of interest, the kinds of concerns driving scientific research become those of the funders, the private individuals who are giving the money. So they can determine which issues, which illness or which, they can determine which issues should get priority, which problems deserve a more urgent solution, which diseases are more important. And there we can see the effects in the prioritization of issues that are experienced more by the wealthy or by the preferences of the wealthy. So that's one concern. Another concern is that privately funded science does not have to be as public. It need not share data or knowledge in the same way. Sometimes, there are different modes. In some cases, philanthropists will just fund scientists. In other cases, there is a profit motive as well. So if research is done in private labs, then it will not be disseminated in the same way. It will not become public knowledge. It will not be used for other public projects. And that also that would change the character of science greatly. And I think to the detriment of the citizenry. So these are concerns. And I think what we need to do is to use the power of public funding as a way to counterbalance the increase of private funding. The U.S. government is expanding scientific funds, doubling the budget of NSF, NIH greatly, and this kind of push hasn't been done in many decades, I think. This is largely to compete with China, but of course it will have ramifications for the kind of science that's possible. And I think this is an opportunity. This is whatever you think of the appropriate level of scientific funding, that there is public funding for science, that taxpayer funding is directed in this way, creates the power to use this for as a response to the private uses of funds. So I see this as an opportunity, and the private activities of philanthropists, Silicon Valley moguls, can be counterbalanced with this kind of push.
So just to sort of, sum up many of the arguments you're making in your book, for a relatively short book, you really do pack in a lot of interesting thoughts and ideas. What would your advice be to, just the average citizen who is not a scientist, but wants to be able to engage in scientific questions? Like where should the average citizen look to find scientific evidence? And what should be the kind of basic approach about what scientific, conclusions, what the value of scientific conclusions are?
I think one of the valuable things that has come out of the pandemic is the excellent science journalism that we have seen. From mainstream newspapers to magazines and scientific publications, I've seen such great analyses, descriptions, commentary, reporting, investigative journalism around all facets of the COVID-19 pandemic, from its distributive implications to what's missing, to the scientific models used, to what mistakes scientists were making, to how policymakers were making judgments that had certain flaws or that prioritized some over others. So I got incredible information from science journalism, and I think that is absolutely the place to go for an ordinary citizen who wants to follow the science, to see what scientists are doing, what implications science has. And the great thing about journalism is that it, setting aside the misinformation problem, I think you can see a spectrum of views, and different perspectives are represented in the media, media sphere in a way that you don't fully see within the scientific community. So you get critiques of scientists that come from both the right and the left and the far right and the far left. And I think that is healthy because academia is becoming more liberal in its composition. Whether that affects the kind of knowledge produced, it seems inevitable that it will. I'm always interested in looking at evidence that it does. And, I'm still looking. It's hard to say with a disease or whatnot how it's shaping it. I think the jury is still out. But it's great to have critiques about policy implications of science or policy advice given based on the science. And this organizes debate and gives people a sense of how the science does and does not shape what we should do. In addition to that, I mean, if a science court were to be tried, I would say they should participate in it or watch it. Debates between scientists when they're hosted on TV shows, I think those are great opportunities to hear things from scientists themselves. So we've seen a lot of scientists holding press conferences, although those had more of a performative aspect and they weren't really discussing the science. So I thought that was an opportunity that wasn't necessarily used in the best way. If they're really into the nitty gritty, some scientific organizations host meetings or public conferences on YouTube. So the UK's Independent Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies has a YouTube channel. They publish their minutes. They give interviews. I really like the public facing aspect of their activities. So I think that's a great way to get information. And they also provide some critique and opposition to the government advisory group. So these have been tremendously valuable, and I recommend them to everyone.
You end the book talking about the importance of recognizing the uncertainty inherent in scientific research. And uncertainty really is something that is, you know, a common theme that you come back to over and over again in the book. And you even talk about when COVID was first hitting the States, how there was this huge debate between scientists about, you know, that were basically dependent on different assumptions that went into models, and that some scientists felt that there was a preference for more extreme models of COVID prediction because of the political implications. You don't make a case either one way or the other of like which models are better. You just sort of say that it's important to understand that there is a nuance when it comes to the uncertainty of models. So how can, you know, the average citizen be prepared to understand this uncertainty and factor in uncertainty when it comes to science and not treating science as necessarily truth? You know, obviously there's this phrase, trust the science. What's the issue with trust the science?
I think this is more about the institutions that relay science to the public. So it's not onto the citizens to know the uncertainty of the science. It's onto institutions that give advice, that publicize science, that show its role in policymaking, or that organize public debates around it, to be more attentive to the uncertainty, to bring it to the foreground so that people know what's uncertain and what can be taken as more or less true. So my argument is entirely oriented toward making this kind of uncertainty public. So I suggest, for example, that advisory groups can have minority reports or dissenting reports that argue for different positions, that highlight what's uncertain. I argue that for a science court where uncertainty would be really at the forefront, disagreement would be emphasized. I argue for transparency more generally. I think journalists covering scientific disputes. Well, so this has been a bit controversial maybe around the climate issue because of the attention given to a really small minority. And I think this has created, this has given people a really bad taste, and people don't want this kind of two sides journalism. I think that's a shame. I think the problem there is the two sides being given equal weight. I think it's important to give alternative perspectives. The problem there was just giving the same minority perspective, which had been refuted or which had been argued against over and over again, and giving it too much weight. But I think that shouldn't make us shy away from emphasizing uncertainty where it exists and, you know, giving it proportionately, showing how many scientists think this and how many think that. That's certainly that certainly should be done. False equivalence is not good, but emphasizing uncertainty is necessary. So I think these kinds of institutions can and should do the work. And I think that would give citizens a better sense of what the uncertainty, where it lies and which models make which assumptions and what the consequences are of those.
Since this book came out, has there been any interesting feedback you've received or any opinions or ideas that you expressed in the book that you have reevaluated?
Well, during the COVID pandemic, it was interesting for me to see the variety of institutional responses. So I was actually, in some ways, I was pleasantly surprised by the support around the view that it is good to share and emphasize uncertainty and disagreement. I think perhaps the climate experience had really made the political sentiment turn against that approach, but the pandemic made it shift because I think it was clear that the science was uncertain and there were a lot of, there's some flip-flopping on policy advice and people, and that didn't help, that made everyone mistrustful. So it became clear that it's good and healthy to emphasize uncertainty. And I actually got more positive reactions to that view than I had before the pandemic, while I was writing the book. I think at that time, people weren't that receptive to this view, that uncertainty in science should be made very public. I think there was much more pushback before the pandemic, and the pandemic changed it. What have I revised? So the lab leak experience was interesting because some of the ideas I put forward, I argue that disagreement is important to emphasize, but I realized in the showdown between the Trump administration and scientists that in some cases there are other political factors that really make scientists reluctant to emphasize their weaknesses or to admit their uncertainty. And I sympathize with that. I don't necessarily say it made me change my mind, but I could see why scientists who felt that the administration was anti-science and had constantly tried to undermine them, when Trump was the one who was pushing for the lab leak theory, scientists sort of banded together and said, no, this lab is doing great work and we're behind it. I think they went too far, but as a political move, that was understandable. So these issues are, of course, context dependent, and there are other political goals that both scientists and politicians are pursuing, which always have to be factored in. So in practice, the theory might have to be modified depending on the stakes. So that's something that was very interesting to observe.
Well, thank you so much for being on the New Books Network, Zeynep. It's been great talking to you. Yeah, I think you offer a lot of interesting things here. Are you working on anything new?
I think my next project is going to be about artificial intelligence and how AI technologies, machine learning technologies are changing democracy, the issues they create for accountability, for fairness, discrimination. So moving from science to technology, it's kind of a natural step. It's not the same issue. And I'm in some ways, I'm much more concerned about AI, even though I had a critical stance towards science. On some level, I do believe science is very important and a force for good in many cases. AI, I guess some would say the same about AI, but just seeing how it's changing the world, I'm much more worried at the moment. I'm getting into this topic, so exploring that is my next project.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's tons of justifiable worry there. That's definitely one of the things I'm most concerned about. So I really look forward to reading that book and hopefully having you on sometime in the future. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Caleb. This was a great conversation. Thank you for inviting me.